From Montpelier, Vermont, this is Public Health Radio. On today's show, we'll be listening to the second part of an interview from Afghanistan. Our guests are two staff members of UNICEF Afghanistan who are working in the aid program, Peter Salama and Annalise Borrell. They will be discussing the public health crisis in Afghanistan and the redevelopment effort that is underway there. Then, later in the show, Judy Wilkenfeld will be joining us to discuss the final stage of the international negotiation convened by the World Health Organization to limit the spread of tobacco addiction into the poor countries of the global south. But first, some news from the world of public health. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. The Alan Guttmacher Institute recently compiled survey data on reproductive outcomes among married women. The survey revealed that the typical American woman marries at age 25 and achieves her desired family size of two children by age 31. She then spends the next 20 years until menopause trying to avoid an unintended pregnancy. Of the 3 million pregnancies that occur each year in married women, over 30% are unintended, so nearly 1 million married women in this country experience an unintended pregnancy each year. Almost 4 out of every 10 unintended pregnancies to married women ends in abortion, and 17% of all abortions occur among married women. More than half of married women who had an abortion in the year 2000 were practicing contraception in the month they became pregnant, but most of these women cited inconsistent use as the reason they became pregnant. Most reproductive health outreach activities target unmarried women, especially teenagers. Cynthia Dillard, the author of the study, concludes that all couples, whether married or not, need accurate information about the probability of pregnancy when contraceptives are not used, as well as the importance of consistent and correct use of methods to avoid unintended pregnancy and sexually transmitted diseases. The report is available at the Alan Guttmacher Institute's website, which is guttmacher.org. On June 30th, 151 organizations active in advocacy for HIV care sent a letter to President Bush and all the members of Congress outlining their concerns regarding a number of Bush administration's HIV-related policies. The letter states that the Bush administration has failed to allow a comprehensive HIV prevention program. Instead, there has been near total emphasis on abstinence. The groups ask that sex education programs address the efficacy of condoms. They characterize the CDC's scrutiny over local HIV programs around the country as relentless and intrusive. Bush administration programs amount to a censorship of potentially life-saving information, according to the coalition. They characterize Bush administration funding of domestic HIV programs as grossly inadequate, and express concern that Bush administration policies of censorship and intimidation put American lives at risk and will increase the number of new HIV cases. The groups instead call for the implementation of science-based HIV prevention models rather than policy based on political expediency and ideology. The letter is available at the National Minority AIDS Council's website, nmac.org. A study released by the prestigious Institute of Medicine recommends that the government encourage everyone to reduce the amount of dioxins in their diet by decreasing their consumption of meat, whole milk, and other foods high in animal fat. Dioxins are residues of natural and industrial combustion, especially of plastics. They have been linked to a variety of adverse health effects, including skin damage, cancer, diabetes in adults, neurological and immune system impairments in infants, and endocrine system disruption. These effects were identified in individuals who had high levels of exposure. Unfortunately, safe levels of dioxin exposure have not yet been determined. Dioxins are transmitted to the human fetus during pregnancy and are transmitted to infants via breast milk. Because fetuses and infants are especially sensitive to the effects of toxic compounds, there should be an effort to reduce girls' and women's exposure to dioxins in foods during the years well before childbearing, so that less of these compounds would accumulate in their bodies prior to pregnancy. The report recommends that the government partner with food makers and farmers to create a plan to reduce dioxins in foods and reduce the amount of dioxins in animal feed and grasses. The report also recommends that the National School Lunch Program and the WIC program should increase the availability of foods that are low in animal fat. The report is available at the Institute of Medicine's website, iom.edu. On July 9th, the U.S. Senate approved an amendment to the State Department Foreign Aid Bill that would repeal the Bush administration's policy of prohibiting international aid from going to family planning agencies abroad that promote or perform abortion. The policy bars U.S. money from international groups that support abortion, even with their own money, through direct services, counseling, or lobbying activities. This policy is commonly referred to as the Mexico City policy. It was originally implemented by President Reagan at a population conference in Mexico City in 1984. The policy was reversed by President Clinton, but then on the first day of his presidency, President Bush reinstated the policy. The foreign aid bill also includes a provision restoring $50 million in aid over a two-year period to the United Nations Population Fund. In July 2002, the Bush administration decided to permanently withhold U.S. support of the Population Fund, arguing that that UN agency tacitly supports the one-child policy in China that has a history of being coercive. The House of Representatives is likely to continue support for the Mexico City policy, and the White House has warned that President Bush would veto the foreign aid bill if it reversed that policy. Supporters of the ban say that people in the U.S. who oppose abortion rights should not have their tax dollars used for foreign programs that indirectly fund abortion services. But those who oppose the Mexico City policy argue that it denies funding to programs that offer a wide array of health services to low-income women who otherwise cannot get such care. One of the groups in South Africa that protested President Bush's African visit was the South African Reproductive Rights Alliance. That group said that Bush's support of the Mexico City policy was responsible for 1.5 million unwanted births, 2.2 million unsafe abortions, 92,000 infant deaths, and 15,000 maternal deaths. The trade lobby for the largest prescription drug companies announced in May that it intended to increase its budget for lobbying by 23%. This means that next year they will spend $150 million on lobbying. Over $72 million will go to lobbying at the federal level. And that's not including the $5 million set aside to lobby the Food and Drug Administration, the federal agency that was created to regulate the drug industry. About $12.3 million is being set aside to develop coalitions and strategic alliances with physicians, patients, universities, and influential members of minority groups. An example of this appeared in late May when an organization called the United Seniors Association paid for newspaper ads supporting President Bush's proposal for a prescription drug plan under Medicare. Since the president's plan had previously received little support among seniors groups, pressure was exerted on the group to disclose its funding. It turned out that close to 100% of the United Seniors Association's budget came from the pharmaceutical industry. Another $1 million has been set aside by pharma to develop a standing network of economists and thought leaders to speak against federal price controls in articles and testimony. One-third of the lobbying money, approximately $50 million, is headed for state governments, though that may change in light of the May 19th Supreme Court decision, freeing up state governments to use novel strategies to obtain lower drug prices for their citizens. An extended segment on state strategies to reduce drug costs aired on last month's show, accessible to web browsers at our website, publichealthradio.org. In late June, Representative Martin Szabo of Minnesota introduced legislation that would place the results of research primarily funded by the federal government into the public domain. The legislation, called the Public Access to Science Act, would make federally funded scientific research available to the public, bypassing the current system of access to journals through paid subscription only. The measure also calls on federal agencies to improve access to their research results. In articulating the need for the legislation, Szabo noted that the public pays about $45 billion annually in taxes to finance the research. He argues that it defies logic to collectively pay for our medical research only to privatize its profitability and availability. The movement to expand access to research studies has struggled to gain traction because scientists are reluctant to abandon the prestige journals in which publication is integral to tenure and promotion decisions. An organization called the Public Library of Science has been in the forefront of the effort to improve access to scientific research. That organization is an international coalition of scientists which came together to improve access. It has founded two online journals of biology and medicine. Its leadership consists of Howard Varmus of the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Institute and former director of the National Institutes of Health, Patrick Brown of Stanford University, and Michael Eisen of the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory. Their website is publiclibraryofscience.org. Coming up next, the public health crisis in Afghanistan. So stay with us. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. For the second time in two decades, the U.S. led a major war in the Central Asian country of Afghanistan. At the time the war ended in December 2001, Afghanistan was among the poorest countries of the world, suffering from high rates of illiteracy, mental and physical disability consequent to the war itself, and high rates of preventable infectious diseases. When the first Afghani war ended in 1989, the U.S. and other wealthy nations did little to foster the redevelopment of the country. So when the U.S. began organizing the more recent military campaign, attention was again focused on the humanitarian crisis in the country, and the Bush administration vowed that it would not abandon the country a second time. Joining us for the second part of a two-part interview on the public health crisis in Afghanistan, we have Peter Salama and Annalise Borrell. Peter Salama has devoted his career to the improvement of public health systems in some of the poorest countries in the world. Since January 2002, Dr. Salama has served in Afghanistan as the Chief of Health and Nutrition for UNICEF Afghanistan. In that capacity, he is responsible for the design and implementation of UNICEF's largest health and nutrition program. Annalise Borrell currently serves as the Senior Food Security and Nutrition Advisor for the Afghani Ministry of Health, as well as UNICEF Afghanistan. During the first portion of the interview, aired on last month's show, we learned about the impact of drought and war on infectious diseases, nutrition, and maternal and child health. That portion of the interview is still available to web browsers at our website, publichealthradio.org. Today we'll discuss the burden of war injuries and landmines, the disruption of the agricultural system, and also the redevelopment effort that is underway. The interview was done via satellite phone from Kabul, the capital city of Afghanistan, and I'd like to warn listeners of the occasional breaks in transmission in the effort to record the interview. Regrettably, the interview could not be conducted in an interactive fashion because my two guests had to share the only phone line available at the UNICEF office in Kabul. Peter Salama and Annalise Borel, welcome back to Public Health Radio.
Thanks, Marvin. Nice to be here.
Hi, Marvin. Thanks.
Now, I know that during the Afghan war, as well as during many wars, many people left the land and therefore stopped producing food, and that had a major impact on agricultural output. Is that now been corrected now that Peter mentioned earlier that the war is still continuing, but I'm just wondering if most agricultural workers and farmers returned and are returning to growing food?
In some areas where their security is ensured, people have been in a position to return. Now, in the northern area, for example, in the northern areas of Afghanistan, people have returned and are beginning to cultivate. And with the improvement in rainfall, this has had a significant impact in terms of increasing production up in the north. Obviously, this is not true for the whole population, and in areas in the southern region and the southeast, and where security still remains a problem, and the drought continues, food production has not necessarily increased. The problem also is that people, throughout the 3 to 4 year drought, people did, by borrowing, through coping mechanisms like borrowing, went into debt, and it's going to take a while for people to pay back credit, particularly as these were outside of their normal kinship and support programs. In particular, people sold livestock. That will take a long time for restocking programs, take a long time, and obviously need to be carefully monitored and supported. Certainly, there's been a change in pattern of people's livelihoods. A lot of migration and family separation, with one member of the family, usually a male member, coming to urban centres to find employment, but still retaining their land and the family in the rural areas. So family separation still continues.
You mentioned that there's, in many cases, the male head of household has left the area to try to seek employment elsewhere, either out of the country or in the urban areas. So I would assume then that has implications for food production if you're missing a major farmer or a farm worker. So is that also make them dependent on child labor? Do children get an education in Afghanistan?
We've seen a remarkable increase in number of children returning to school, particularly girl children, but obviously some families do rely on child labor, particularly families in carpet weaving up in the northern parts. Children are employed for carpet weaving. We also see, as you may know, Afghanistan has a number of salt mines, crude salt mines, and child labor is used to basically harvest the salt from these salt mines. So in a number of it, an income generating program opportunities for families, the child labor is used. But certainly we have seen children are returning back to school. Women are involved in food production activities, and older male members of the family will stay with women in rural areas and participate in food production activities.
Now,
Afghanistan is one of the major opium-growing areas of the world, and I was wondering what the implications of that are on health in Afghanistan. Are there actually substance abuse issues?
There isn't much information on the level of substance abuse in Afghanistan, but we do know it's a problem. With many of the refugees returning from Pakistan and Iran, we know that in the refugee camps, Afghan refugee camps in those countries, that the intravenous drug use and other forms of drug use does occur and is quite prevalent. And we do know that that there is a group of intravenous drug users already in most urban centres in Afghanistan. And we only imagine that with the return of already 2 million refugees last year, another 1.5 million expected this year, that this problem will only get worse in Afghanistan. But we don't have exact figures on numbers. We do know it's a problem.
Do you believe that HIV may be a problem along with that due to needle sharing?
Yeah, absolutely. We think that at the moment HIV prevalence is actually extremely low, and we do have some data from blood banks to support that statement. But we also know that we have a critical opportunity in Afghanistan to prevent a large-scale HIV epidemic. In this region of the world, HIV epidemics have largely been driven, at least in the initial stages, by intravenous drug use and sharing of needles, and also by poor blood transfusion practices. So in the initial stages of prevention work for HIV, these are really the key areas that UNICEF, in conjunction with the Ministry of Health, is focusing on in terms of HIV prevention.
Now, I would imagine that physical disability resulting from injuries must be a pretty prevalent in Afghanistan as well. And I know that Afghanistan is reported to be one of the most landmine-ridden countries, so this may not be going away. I was wondering if you could provide our listeners with a picture of physical disability from as consequences of the wars.
Yeah, certainly. There's some good recent information on this, actually, from a national survey done by CDC and UNICEF, and it basically shows that more than 1 in 100 children in Afghanistan are disabled. And this is from a combination of factors, of course, partially related to disease, partially related to accidents, and then with a large proportion of that disability related to war-related injuries, including landmines. And this is extremely tragic because 70% of these injuries are in the civilian population, these landmine injuries. And it really affects a very important age group of older children and adolescents and young adults. And when we look at some of the factors and some of the risk factors for landmine injury in Afghanistan, they are things that are related to your previous question, Marvin, about livelihood strategies. Many of the biggest risk factors for landmine injury in this country are things like tending animals, farming, collecting water, going to market, and for children, playing is one of the biggest risk factors. In terms of war-related injuries, landmines, in fact, is only one component. In fact, the majority of injuries are caused by bombs and grenades, according to this recent study. And then the second category is related to firearms, with landmines being the third category of war-related injury, and in fact being less prevalent than the previous two. To focus for a minute on landmines specifically, yes, you're right. In fact, it's believed that Afghanistan is probably the most densely infested landmine country in the world, with some 10 million landmines remaining, which is around 10% of the global burden of landmines internationally. And it's believed that in the course of the last decade, around 20,000 people have been killed and 400,000 injured by landmines alone in this country. There are some good programs, though, up and running. One is led by United Nations organization called MAPA. And basically, this employs around 5,000 Afghan workers. And it's estimated that to clear 1 square kilometer of landmines in Afghanistan only costs around US dollars, so 77 cents, basically, to clear 1 square kilometer of and land from landmines, which is pretty impressive by any standards in terms of cost effectiveness. As well as the landmine clearance aspect of this program, there's another key aspect, which is awareness raising for landmines. And this year alone, UNICEF has trained more than 10,000 teachers in landmine awareness, who will then go in their classrooms and raise the level of awareness amongst their pupils. But even with these very large programs, it's estimated that it's going to take up to a decade if we have very good support from the international community to clear the remaining landmines in this country.
Let's talk a little now perhaps about medical services in Afghanistan. Are there enough doctors in Afghanistan, and do they speak the languages that the people speak?
In fact, the shortage of doctors is probably not the major problem in terms of the health system in Afghanistan. There are actually thousands of well-qualified Afghan doctors who really support the healthcare system in Afghanistan. And certainly they've not had access to the refresher training and the latest medical literature that they should have in the last 20 years. But in fact, the major problem in Afghanistan is the distribution of health services, particularly to the rural areas. And because of the history of Afghanistan, many of the non-government and international organizations, until 2001, were actually based in the western region of Pakistan rather than in Afghanistan itself, for security reasons predominantly. And because of their base, they actually tended to target the eastern part of Afghanistan for services much more than, say, the south or west of the country. And there's still very large swathes of the central, western, and southern parts of the country that really have little or no access to medical services. And so the key issue here for organizations like UNICEF and the big donors in the country, USAID, the World Bank, and the European Commission, is to try and, through their funding, encourage international and national non-government organizations to really prioritize these underserved areas of the country.
Now, I was wondering if you could talk about literacy, because I know that that has a big impact on health. And it must maybe an issue, a gender issue as well, whether women are literate. So if you could talk about that for a second.
Sure. You're right in both your assumptions. Literacy is a huge issue in Afghanistan, or I should say the lack of literacy. It's thought that less than 5% of women in this country are literate. And in fact, even the statistics for men are not substantially greater. They are a little bit better than that, but there is still a real problem with literacy for men as well in this country. In terms of what to do about it, first of all, the important thing is to make sure that future generations of Afghan are not illiterate, and that's really been a priority for UNICEF in the last 18 months. And in fact, more than 3 million children have gone back to school in the course of the last 18 months in a joint UNICEF and Ministry of Education program. So the first step, I guess, is really to prevent future generations from suffering this problem. The second step is what to do about these large cohorts of women in the last two decades are now illiterate, but are either older adolescents or fully grown adults. And there are many programs supported by non-government organizations as well as UN agencies that support out-of-school literacy training for women and adult learning education for women. And these are really going to need to be expanded and tried to include the majority of Afghan women. But clearly there are also cultural constraints to this, just as there are in women's access to health services, so there are in women's access to educational services. And although education for women is by and large very well received in Afghanistan, we have had incidences in parts of the country of schools and school tents being burnt down, clearly by small elements of the population who are trying to discourage their communities from seeking access for girls' education.
Well, let's take a short break. For those who just joined us, our guests are Annalise Borel and Peter Salama, and we've been discussing the public health crisis in Afghanistan. After the break, We'll talk about the redevelopment effort there. Then later in the show, Judy Wilkenfeld will be joining us to discuss the conclusion of the international treaty negotiation aimed at controlling the spread of tobacco. So stay with us. Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. We've been listening to the second part of an interview with Annelise Borel and Peter Salama. Annelise and Peter are two of the leaders of UNICEF's Afghanistan program, and we've been discussing the public health crisis there. Back to the interview. You've painted a picture of a fairly comprehensive crisis in public health where availability of balanced nutrition, availability of safe drinking water, immunization, the presence of millions of landmines, that all of these are threats to the current public health and the future. From the U.S. perspective, we heard our administration make a commitment after the recent Afghan war to really make sure that Afghanistan really did develop this time, and not just abandon the country as occurred after the previous Afghan war of the 1980s. But then only a year later, the U.S. began to focus on Iraq, and since you're in Afghanistan, you may not realize this, but the media in the U.S. have just dropped Afghanistan totally. We almost never hear about it, and I worry that that might also be true in the other wealthy countries of Europe and Eastern Asia, Japan, and maybe Australia. I don't know if Afghanistan is still on the radar screen there either, but I worry about that. And I guess what I want to ask you is, you've described all these problems, so do you feel that the response and the amount of intensity of the international aid effort is really going to break through and make a big difference?
Thanks for the question, Marvin. The answer is clearly not a simple one. Firstly, you're absolutely right. I mean, the international media in most of these post-conflict and conflict settings tends to have a very short attention span and tends to move on to the next conflict or post-conflict situation relatively quickly. I think it's going to take sustained support from the international community if we're really going to have an effect on the development of Afghanistan. And in terms of the comparison between Iraq and Afghanistan, I think it's important to point out that there are real needs in both countries. And I would argue that the people of both countries deserve long-term international support so they can develop and so they can have the same sort of health opportunities that we have in the developed world. So I would say it shouldn't have to be a choice between Iraq or Afghanistan, but both peoples of both countries should have opportunities to develop. In terms of the donor support so far, I think Afghanistan, I think donors have made substantial pledges to Afghanistan in the past 18 months. And what's very important is that those pledges are followed through with real commitments in financial terms, and that these commitments are then sustained. A program like maternal mortality reduction, for example, will not work unless there's multi-year sustained funding to develop the sophisticated services that are required to to reduce this kind of level of maternal mortality. So I think the important thing to get across is that this is not a 1 or 2 year problem. This is a long-term development issue. It's taken more than 25 years to get Afghanistan into this very, very difficult circumstance, and it's going to take a similar period of time to pull it out of this mire. But having said that, I think it's also important to say that there are a lot of positive things going on in terms of successes like the measles campaign that I mentioned earlier, and in terms of children going back to school, in terms of capacity being developed by institutions in the line ministries such as the Ministry of Health, and in terms of the people's willingness, the Afghan people's willingness and commitment to address these problems themselves. And I'd like to give you one example of that gives me hope for the future in terms of public health in Afghanistan. And that is an example of a program that we've been involved with this year on the universal salt iodization. Iodine deficiency is a major problem in this country and affects quite a large swathe of the country. In fact, we think the majority of the country suffers from this problem. And as well as causing the more cosmetic problems such as goiter, we estimate that iodine deficiency in Afghanistan decreases the mean IQ across the country by anywhere between 10 and 15 percentage points. So this is obviously having a major effect on intelligence, on school performance, on language development, and on the long-term social and economic development of this country. And to tell you one story, this year we asked a lot of the private salt traders and producers in Kabul to get together and for the first time to form a cooperative. And this is what they've done, and they've actually invested around $20,000 of their own money. UNICEF has then gone in after they made that commitment and purchased machinery and iodate for the iodization of salt. And in fact, now this private-public partnership is extremely successful. The cooperative has recouped the entire investment it's made into the country. And the World Food Program, which used to import all of its iodized salt from outside the country, has just signed a contract with this cooperative to purchase all of the salt locally that they need for Afghanistan. And this is the kind of project using the private sector as an engine, if you like, that can have a real effect with actually very limited external funding, can have a real effect on population health and development for many, many years to come. And it's those kind of examples that give us hope here in Afghanistan.
Just to add to the importance and to emphasize the importance of sustained resources for these types of public health interventions, continue with the same example of the iodine deficiency and the fortification of salt. Obviously, this is a longer-term program. We need to extend it from Kabul, from a central level, to other parts of the country. We need to include legislation and ensure that iodized salt reaches all parts of the country, not just in the central highlands, in the central area. So certainly, this is going to take sustained resources and continued monitoring. Another nutritional problem which is going to require sustained resources and support is scurvy caused by a deficiency in vitamin C. We have seen recurrent outbreaks of scurvy in the last several years, and as an emergency response have distributed vitamin C tablets to whole villages in high-risk areas. However, this is only a short-term intervention, and certainly we are aware and are conscious of the importance of ensuring that people have opportunities to produce vitamin C-rich foods and have much more sustainable options for consuming vitamin C-rich foods.
What does that involve? What does that involve? Do you have to try to get farmers there to distribute seeds of new crops of foods that would contain vitamin C, and do you have to get them to change what they're used to growing?
It's actually something that we're just looking at the moment. We're certainly looking at food processing, local food processing techniques, for example, germinating wheat. As you know, Afghanistan, the whole population, the main staple food is wheat. When wheat is during early germination, there's a high vitamin C content in the wheat, and we're looking at how if people during the germination stage, this will increase vitamin C consumption. Obviously, in some areas where climate is suitable, but that's not all areas. Production of citrus fruits and facilitating trade and market systems so that these citrus fruits reach more inaccessible areas where citrus is not produced. We're also looking at food processing and drying of foods rich in vitamin C. So we're looking at a different number of options, but it's going to be hugely challenging. Another area, just to emphasize again the importance of sustained resources. There are no nutritionists in the country, and currently at the moment, as we establish a department for nutrition department in the Ministry of Health, there are no professional nutritionists to support that.
Most massive aid efforts combine private sector corporations, non-governmental charitable organizations like the Red Cross, as well as relevant UN agencies such as UNICEF. President Bush's team initially developed a plan to use largely private sector multinational corporations to rebuild Iraq, relying less on private sector enterprise within the country and de-emphasizing the role of the United Nations. Recently, the president has begun to reverse his position, allowing for a larger role for the UN. I was wondering if you could comment on the different roles these three types of organizations offer the redevelopment effort.
Thanks, Marvin. I can't comment specifically on the situation in Iraq because I don't have first-hand experience. But in terms of the overall approach, I think it's very much necessary to use a combination of public international institutions and private institutions in most of these post-conflict settings. They both have different comparative advantages and I think very different roles to play. In Afghanistan, the United Nations system has been very important on one hand on the political and security side, but also in terms of the delivery of humanitarian assistance. It has the ability to work on a national level, to work with governments to build their capacity and to mobilize a significant cadre of qualified professionals who have done this before in many, many other countries. And I think probably in those aspects there is an advantage there over similar private sector institutions. And in fact, I don't think there are many similar private sector agencies that compare to institutions such as UNICEF, WHO, UNFPA, and the multilateral bank such as the World Bank. So I think there is a special role for those kinds of institutions. In terms of the private sector, I think we've discussed one example already in the interview of a real role for the private sector in terms of taking on a program like universal salt iodization and being able to expand it and replicate it across the country in a way that perhaps can happen far more quickly in some settings than the public sector could do it. But there's still even a role in that private sector-driven program, as Annalise explained, for the public sector in terms of developing the guidelines and standards and the monitoring and even kicking off the entire program and also making sure that the government is linked in with the private sector for quality assurance and for overall management of the whole project. So I think very much there's a role for both public and private sector in these kinds of settings, because there are such huge needs for rebuilding and reconstruction, and there's no shortage of work.
And what role have foreign corporations played in the redevelopment effort in Afghanistan?
Yes, there are certainly large private contractors in Afghanistan who will be working on elements of reconstruction. For example, many of the health clinics will be constructed through private contractors, and there's a huge need for literally hundreds of health clinics to be built. Also in other sectors such as education, private companies are being used. And certainly for large infrastructure projects like road rebuilding and development, private companies are being used. So yes, there is a role for even foreign companies to come into Afghanistan from the private sector. And, there is a role for both sectors.
Now, for listeners who would like to learn more about this issue, can you point out a few useful websites?
The first I would point out is the UNICEF website, which is www.unicef.org, And also listeners can make donations to the Afghanistan or other country programs on online or by phone through that website. There are also other websites that information on Afghanistan and other countries affected by complex emergencies. One is www.reliefweb.org.
Now, you mentioned the possibility of listeners donating to UNICEF as a potential action they could take to help. Are there other ways? Is it important for people to contact their legislators and make sure that we remain involved? Do you feel that's important, or other possible venues?
There are many other organizations working in Afghanistan, including non-government organizations based in the U.S., where people could make their personal contributions, and if they have relevant expertise, also perhaps work for many of those organizations in Afghanistan and other countries where expertise and experience is really needed. As well as that, for sure, as much as people can do to keep the issues and the very poor circumstances that face the population of Afghanistan on the media and political agenda through their own avenues is greatly appreciated by all.
Well, Peter Salama and Annalise Borel, I'd like to thank you for joining us on Public Health Radio.
Thanks very much, Marvin. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Marvin. Thanks very much.
Coming up next, the World Health Organization's sponsored treaty negotiation to limit the spread of tobacco use. So stay with us. For years, the big tobacco companies have been pushing to get individuals in the poor countries of the global south to take up smoking. And in recent years, they've been successful. Tobacco smoking has been increasing in many of the poorest countries of the world. To stem the spread of this deadly habit, the World Health Organization convened a treaty negotiation in 1999, and that treaty negotiation was completed last month. Judy Wilkenfeld has spent over 15 years bringing the practices of the tobacco industry to the light of day and attempting to thwart their efforts to recruit a new generation of reliable customers. She's worked on the tobacco issue at the Federal Trade Commission and at the Food and Drug Administration, and currently she works on the issue at the Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids and has directed their effort to monitor the international treaty negotiation. She's joining us today to discuss the final treaty agreement. Judy Wilkenfeld, welcome to Public Health Radio.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
So bring us the news. This treaty negotiation on tobacco was completed last week. Tell us about that agreement.
It was indeed. The treaty itself will now be open for signing and ratification because of the actions taken last week, which would have been May 21st, I think. Up until the very last minute, the United States tried to weaken the treaty and make it more acceptable to the United States and, from our perspective, to the, Philip Morris. They failed, and the assembled nations voted by consensus to put the treaty into place and to be available for signing and ratification.
So tell us, what's in the final agreement?
The agreement itself contains a roadmap for comprehensive tobacco control that, if followed by each nation, will bring a dramatic change to the way the tobacco companies can operate. It has two very, very strong provisions. One is a mandatory comprehensive tobacco ad ban treaty that would prevent all advertising and sponsorship by tobacco companies.
You mean like sponsorship of sporting events and things like
that? Formula One. Like the automobile races, anything that company sponsors. But it also includes the type of concerts for young people that the tobacco companies sponsor around the world. So it would stop all of that and would stop all of the advertising, billboards, internet, television, print. And that would go in effect 5 years from the date that a country ratifies the treaty. The other is the requirement that any country that signed within 3 years undertake to have warning labels that are a minimum of 30%, but if possible, 50% of the package on the two principal display areas, with every attempt to have those include pictures as well as stark warnings. The other provisions in the treaty that the countries should undertake to make as comprehensive as possible would include restrictions on secondhand smoke, product regulation, and a whole host of other issues that need to be addressed.
Including taxation? Was
that on
the list?
Including taxation, yes. One of the provisions recognizes that high prices is the best way to prevent youth initiation and to help convince people that cessation is an option. Prices are important.
The opposition to this treaty primarily came from Germany and the United States, at least.
Germany, Japan, and the United States.
Those Germany has tobacco. I know that Japan has a large tobacco company, and the U.S. does. Is that also true for Germany?
Yes, Germany has a company. It's called Retzma. I think Retzma is probably fourth largest in the world.
And all three countries, including the Bush administration's negotiating team, they've all now given in to this treaty.
In varying and differing degrees. The first to cave would have been Japan. And Japan actually has a unique position because it not only is the home to the second largest tobacco exporter in the world, but it is in fact part owner of that company, Japan Tobacco. Japan indicated about a week before the meeting at the World Health Assembly that it would not oppose the adoption of the treaty and would in fact sign and ratify. Germany held out to right before the meeting in Geneva. The reason that Germany was so important was that the European Union must vote as a bloc, and any one country can prevent the entire bloc of 27 European Union accession and associate countries from voting. So getting Germany's agreement was very, very important. They also agreed finally by the end not to block the adoption, and that the European Union would sign and ratify. What happened with the United States was somewhat different. Up until the very last minute, they continued to try to weaken the treaty. Just 2 weeks before the meeting, they sent a letter to the ministries of foreign affairs of all of the countries of the world asking that the treaty be further weakened. In treaty negotiations, there's a provision that's called a reservation. If a treaty allows a country to take a reservation, it means that they can sign the treaty and say, yeah, but I don't actually like provision number 7 and number 13. So when I sign, I'm signing on all of the treaty except for provision 13 and 7. This significantly weakens the effect of the treaty because it allows each country to decide what they will and will not accept. And the whole purpose of a treaty is to bind the world together in a uniform pattern. So they sent this to each of the countries of the world. A firestorm of media opposition broke out in the United States, which was then transferred to the rest of the world through the non-governmental organizations that work on this. By the time the meetings were held in Geneva, there were only one or two countries willing to support the United States in this position, recognizing that they had been isolated and that both Japan and Germany were also going to now sign and ratify. The U.S. Dropped its attempts to weaken the treaty. But as Secretary Thompson said in his statement endorsing the adoption of the treaty, was that the U.S. would now support adoption, but that was not an indication that the U.S. would either sign or ratify. The president, he said, still had to read the document and decide for himself whether this was something the U.S. wanted to be bound by. So other than the Dominican Republic, the only country in the world that said it would not sign and ratify was the United States.
So do you believe that we ultimately will? It has to get through the Senate and the House.
Well, you know, I think first we'd have to figure out whether the president will sign. You know, I think he should. There's not much in this treaty that would require too many changes in the United States law. I think the major change would be just we would have to get legislation through mandating a larger health warning. I would give it less than a 50-50 chance that he would sign, and if he did sign, an even smaller chance that the Senate might ratify. On the other hand, this is a pretty easy treaty to sign. It might be one that they might.
So we, those of us who are concerned about the spread of tobacco smoking, should contact our legislators? Would that be a useful strategy?
That would be useful, although at this point it's a matter of whether the president will sign. That is solely his prerogative at this point. From the point of view of the rest of the world, however, the treaty is a success whether the U.S. signs or not. The purpose of this treaty is really to protect the developing world. The products that are made in the developing world are generally less highly manufactured, they can be less addictive, they're often less toxic. They're certainly not marketed with the same glitz and same force that American products are. The treaty will hopefully protect those countries. There's not much effect that the treaty would have either in Europe or in the United States or Canada where the laws are already in place. But it is important to the developing world, and that's why getting their sign on was very important. When the World Bank looked at the countries of Asia and Southeast Asia that the U.S. First opened up to American-style cigarettes, back in the 80s in the Reagan administration, the U.S. Trade Representative used the force of its trade might to open up the markets of Thailand, Taiwan, Japan, and South Korea. Only Thailand fought. The opposition and the World Trade Organization insisted that they open up to American products. What the World Bank found was that smoking rates increased 10% more than they would have without the introduction of American-style cigarettes and marketing. So that's what we're trying to. That's what this treaty and we are trying to prevent, that kind of increase in smoking.
Where might interested listeners get more information on this issue and on the treaty?
Well, the best place, I would say, is to look at our website, which is tobaccofreekids.org, and then go to the global part of our website. We have all of the information and most of the links to the other websites around the world that have information. You can also go to the U.S. Center for Disease Control, the CDC website, cdc.gov, and then go to the Office on Smoking or Health, or go to the WHO, the World Health Organization's website, who.int, and again, look for information both on tobacco and for the Framework Convention on Tobacco Control.
Well, Judy Wilkenfeld, I want to thank you for joining us again on Public Health Radio.
Thank you very much.
Well, that's it for today's show. If you want to give us some feedback, or if you missed part of today's show and want to hear it, or want to tune into any of our previous shows, check out our website, publichealthradio.org. That's one word, publichealthradio.org. Thanks for listening, and join us again next month for another airing of Public Health Radio.